Hello. Welcome to the Roll Together podcast. Thank you for joining us for these podcast versions of our streamed shows from Twitch. You can always find our schedule of upcoming shows at twitch.tv/RollTogetherRPG/schedule. Please do leave a review, and we look forward to adventuring together.
Welcome to Talk Together. Thank you for joining us for an evening of talking about Dungeons & Dragons. I am Rebecca Hare. I will be your host tonight, and I will be chatting to the fantastic Ed Cartwright, who you can see here. So first things first, Ed, I'm sure anyone who has ever watched a stream knows and loves you, but for those few poor people who haven't, do you want to introduce yourself and tell us a bit about yourself?
Okay, my name is Edward Cartwright. I'm an actor, and I live on a boat, which is what you can see around me. What else? I'm having a very fun time. I'm living my best life, I guess. And this very much includes playing Dungeons and Dragons. Oh yeah, that was I think what I would say. So I've been playing, this sounds appallingly hipster, but I have been playing Dungeons and Dragons on and off for the past 25 years. And I love the fact that it's only in the last sort of 5 years that it's come to the thing of now it can be like an opening line in a bar. As you say, I play Dungeons and Dragons. Do you play Dungeons and Dragons? Whereas previously that would have got you ostracized. Now that's all changed around a bit. And the fact that I get to play it on the net is basically the best thing in the world.
It is impossibly cool that we get to do this and call it, like, it's not quite a job, but it's awesome.
A remunerative hobby. That's great.
Yeah, it's brilliant. So this evening, for the next hour or so, we'll be going through some questions, some anecdotes, probably, knowing us, quite a lot of tangents.
Yes,
and as for the questions that I ask, I don't get to pick them. The dice will decide, which is the best possible way. However, before we kick off, just a little bit of admin. As I've said, we'll run for an hour or thereabouts. We are delighted to be sponsored by HeroForge, Ultra Pro and Elderwood Academy, and also to be supported by D&D Beyond, Warriors of Waterdeep and Level Up Dice. We are Roll Together RPG on all social media, and as always, a huge thank you to our wonderful D20 Club on Patreon. Check them out, join the Dice Heads. They are the nicest people.
Yes.
Our shows are available as podcasts. Just search Roll Together RPG on your favorite podcasting app. We should be there. And just one little note, this is going to be the last Talk Together, don't panic, just the last Talk Together on a Saturday. From next week, we're on at the same time, so 6 p.m. BST on a Friday night. So we're just shifting from a Saturday night to a Friday night, but everything else should feel very much the same. Ed, shall we just jump straight in and roll the die?
Yes, let's do that. Let's see what
Okay. I don't have the aplomb of some of our other hosts, so I don't feel quite up to the game show chanting. However...
No, don't do that.
That is... Oh, what a great question to start with. That is a 3.
Okay.
Ed, what is your favourite character class?
Oh, okay, this is really difficult. So first of all, I haven't played all of the character classes, which I feel like is an oversight, because the thing is, for a long time, I would only be a tank. Well, not a tank, but kind of like a fighty person, because I felt like... how do you put it? I didn't get it. Like, so a lot of the, because we were younger, a lot of the people who I was playing D&D campaigns with, we wouldn't get that deep into them because either we'd get bored or we wouldn't meet up enough. And therefore, because we only had early level characters, any early level spellcast was always very squishy, which is a shame because they're the ones that are the most likely to get killed then if you do something stupid. I was prone to doing stupid things in my early D&D escapades, and therefore if I was something that was a tank, then it was more fun because then I would be the one rushing and bashing stuff, and it just felt like it made more sense to me. However, my favorite character that I played so far, I think, has probably been my bard character, Viorica. I think I've played a whole campaign with you as
Viorica,
and that was
Viorica
so much fun.
Is beautiful in so many ways.
Well, this is the thing, but also I was told when I created Viorica, we don't necessarily want someone who will be adventurer savvy, definitely nothing overpowered. And I created Viorica as a kind of innocent abroad in the Dungeons and Dragons world, which actually worked very, very well. Not in the campaign that you and I played, because by then he's become much more of an actual adventurer, and I think that worked. But so I think the problem is that rather than pick a class and then create a character in that class, I create a character and then pick the class that I think that they'd most suit.
Oh, that's really cool. Okay.
You see what I mean? I think, well, yeah, because... yeah, because I think that if you're going to create a character, then creating a bard or a warrior or a wizard is slightly... you don't create as well-rounded a character then. Because I think that what you want to get from your character is a reason why they are what they are, not that they are what they are and that's their reason for being. Do you see what I mean? It's yes. Slightly the other way around. But in terms of what I think the coolest one is, probably Monk. Because I like the key points and I like the whole deflecting and stuff. The thing is, I've never seen a monk at any level higher than like 6, I think. So I don't know what they can do.
I got to play, I think Persephone went up to level 12 in Gloomfalls on Baldur's Gate. And it's just, how dare you? No, it was so much fun. But yeah, can confirm that if you want those like kick-ass, I just, you know... climbed 100 feet in the air and then killed a monster with my bare hands. Like, yeah. Moments. Monks are so good for that.
Awesome. Well, okay, but also the thing is, though, and this is the small tangent, which I think we're allowed. Creating a character to be a character that already exists, for instance, Yoda, or something like that. If you're like, I want to, because one of the earliest characters I created with Chris, who is the doyen of Roll Together, I created a gnome gunslinger. And realized it was really cool. But we then realized halfway through the first session of the campaign, it's like, okay, you created Batman, which is fine. But I don't want to play Batman. I wanted to play my character. And actually what that led on to, because that was a campaign, what's it called? Something about the Underdark. I can't remember what the thing was called. But basically, there were a load of big spiders, and this gunslinger character got trapped by the spiders and committed suicide in a very, very beautiful way. I understand that sounds weird.
Oh, no, you talked a bit about this campaign last time. It sounded right. Spectacularly weird, but brilliant.
Well, that's what I mean. But the thing is, what it meant that I got to do is play...
Your gelatinous cube!
Yes, the Glabagool. Now, that really was... I wouldn't say it was my favourite just because it was so mental, but it was a lot of fun to do. And that's what I mean. It was that's the kind of way that I really... Because rather than playing Batman, therefore, I got to play a thing that I couldn't even have imagined. And I would prefer it that way around. So not playing Batman, but playing the thing that I couldn't...
Yes. Imagine. I find it bizarre. I never intentionally build a character around someone who exists, but then I can look back and go, oops. So do you know Firefly?
Yes, very well, exactly.
I have a bard... And she's in a home game and I love her. She has lots of sharp edges and is quite complicated and she makes me very happy. Yeah. And I thought I'd pulled her straight out of my head and she's brilliant and wonderful and completely unique. And then someone pointed out, did you combine Inara, the, you know, the Esther courtesan, and Zoe, the incredibly kick-ass fighting second in command to make Mira your bard? And I went...
but hang on, because I think that because I agree with that, because it might well have been the case, but the thing is that in order to identify somebody, people look for things that they already know, if you see what I mean. So I think that you could easily have brought that up, but only combined two things which are two of your favorite characteristics. I would therefore say that that is not plagiarism per se, but just enjoying the thing that you can, because like combining those two characters would be amazing. And if you
a lot of fun.
If you called her Aria Zoe, then it would be a bit of a thing. But because you created a thing yourself, I think that works. And also the thing is, D&D is awful for recreating stereotypes. And that's what I mean. I think that I wouldn't want to play as a stereotype because I think it'd be boring. And therefore combining two characters, I think, isn't quite
doing that.
it's changing the thing around.
You are wise. I think also, not to get too feminist, but this was one of my earlier characters when I was still sort of looking around the fantasy universe for people to kind of... There weren't, you know, it's getting a lot better now, but there are a lot fewer female archetypes if you want to play a definitely female character.
Absolutely.
Guys get a lot easier. Whereas now I'm, you know, several years more experienced and will just pull a character that I think is fun without having to look at archetypes and stereotypes. But at the start I was going, but I don't... What in the triangle of, like, cute, kick-ass sexy, where do I want to be?
Do I want to be a Mary Sue? Like, no, you don't.
Yes.
There needs to be a more rounded character thing. Yeah, no, I agree. And also I think that's experience, as you talk about, is really, really important, because I may have talked about this in the last one as well, but when I came into a proper game with Chris for the first time, it was... What were we playing? It was another, like, pre-created campaign, I think. But I was... No, it wasn't at all pre-created. We were playing gods from any pantheon you wanted. But the idea was that it was a place where the gods had disappeared but were then coming back because they started dying. And so it was a really, really cool idea. And I got to play Odin because... Chris was like, you've played this before and a lot of other people completely haven't played this, so why don't you play Odin? We'll give you guidance and it means that you can help out. And I was playing so much worse than everybody else. Everyone really got the idea and I was like, no, but we must conserve our spells. It was really, I mean, it was good, but the thing was that it made me realize that, like, historic experience, having just played it for a long time, did not mean I was any good. Which was a shame to find out, having played it for 15 years at that stage already. It's kind of like, oh, no. But yeah, no, I think that, because that's what I mean. Experience, I think, doesn't mean just having played it for a long time, but it means playing lots of different characters and getting yourself into as many situations which are unusual, even by D&D standards, I think, which relies on good other players and a good DM.
Yeah, for sure. Yes, you can never quite... It doesn't matter what character you have in your head if you can't play it at a table with other people.
That is exactly the thing.
Shall we roll the dice again?
Yes,
let's see what happens. We've got through one whole question. I feel we're doing well. Oh, I found this one really difficult when I had to answer it. This is a 7.
Mm.
So this is there a moment in a TTRPG that impacted your life out of game?
Oh, Lord. I mean, yes, dozens. But are they coherent? Because I don't sort of try and live my life the way that D&D characters would live their lives, because that
reasonable.
Would be insane.
We like staying alive.
A little bit. And also, yeah, exactly. And just trying to hoard gold. I mean, I guess we technically do that. But, like, anyway. But I think that if I was going to pick one, it would be any of the deaths of my characters, because I feel those pretty hard, which is good, but it's not very nice, if you see what I mean, as in, like, it's not something you want to go through each time. But I think it's vital, if you're going to play a character properly, that the stakes are high enough that if they do die, then it really matters. And so, just to get slightly morbid for a second, I've been to far more funerals than the average bear, apparently. And for a long time, I stopped myself feeling at them, if you see what I mean. It was, I think it was that it's kind of in my family and stuff, like, it's not sort of good to cry at funerals and stuff like that. Not because it's a bad thing to do, but more because it's like, it's upsetting for everybody else. Mm. So big sort of overt displays of affection were not encouraged. And so it's only been later in my life when I've actually been able to process and start grieving for somebody when I've gone to their funeral. And I think it's slightly the same thing with characters. It starts off and you just want to make the biggest and baddest and most terrifying character ever, and they tend to be a stereotype, which means that when they die, they're kind of like, oh, I want to build another one now. It's just going to be annoying to have to get it to that sort of level of power again. But then when you actually start creating characters which you are interested in and which actually matter to the story, and to the story matters to them, then all of a sudden, if they do die, then it can become a thing of, I'm never going to play with that character again, in both ways, as in, like, playing with them as in playing the role-playing game, but playing with them as in going, I don't know what you're going to do. I would love to find out what the rest of your story is going to be. And that's the thing that makes me, because the writers like Tolstoy, the famous Russian fella, his great thing used to be like, I love all my characters and I'm really interested what they end up doing in the next session of writing that I'm doing. Now, of course, he has control of the writing, so normally he gets to control what they do. But I love somebody who can give their characters free rein enough, and I think this is really important for a character in D&D, give them free rein enough that you really don't know what's going to happen. And I think that's kind of the most important thing. And I think that it has allowed me to process loss better by losing characters. It's kind of in the same way as I would say that D&D is fantastic, like first stage therapy. I would not say do not replace therapy with D&D. That doesn't work. But at the same time, you can put yourself and, or like a version of yourself, your character, in a position and, as it were, play out a thing that you're scared of in real life, or that worries you in real life, or something like that. And it allows you to at least give yourself a thing of like, oh, that wasn't as scary as I thought it was going to be. Because often fear is scarier than the actual thing that you're afraid of and all of that kind of stuff. So from that point of view, I would say it allows you to go through experiences that you wouldn't usually go through, like, at all in your real life, unless you're quite a psychopath. But also that means that you can go through stuff and see that it's not potentially as bad as you thought it was.
I have to ask, because we are both actors, Do you find a similar experience when playing a character on stage?
100%.
Does it change, though, when you've created the character and you are improvising every second?
Ooh, that's a very good question.
Thank you.
Because your character has to be the way that you've rehearsed it, kind of. I mean, obviously, there's room for maneuver on stage, but if you do too much room for maneuver, then the director's going to come up to you and go, what the hell was that? However, there is an oppressiveness to a character when you're on stage, in as much as if it's there's an oppressiveness if you're playing a Shakespearean character. If you're playing a character who's never been played before, then obviously you get to do whatever you want, and that is kind of more interesting. But a really, really good character, like not Evelyn Waugh, what's his name? Oscar Wilde, like an Oscar Wilde character or a Shakespearean character, there's a certain duty of care that you have, I think, with those characters, as in, like, this had better be good. And good doesn't mean different. Good can mean just doing it the way that you want to, if you see what I mean. But I think that your own character is so much more yours than almost any character, even one that you've written for yourself, can be. Then I think, and also like, there's a cliche, which is that every D&D character you make is some form of you. I don't think that that's necessarily true, but I do think that you get the sense of it being you much more, and it's much easier to make decisions as a character in D&D than it is make decisions as a character on stage, I would say. But yes, very good question.
Why, thank you. Should we have another one?
Yes.
Okay.
Let's do that.
I'm using my lovely level up die, and it is making the nicest clonk sound ever. Yeah, I have, people who know my usual luck will be astounded, I have rolled a nat one. But it's a really good question. Ed, what is your most epic character moment? I feel you have a whole wealth to choose from. So have fun picking just one.
Oh, yeah, no, this is... Okay. So there's several things. I presume I talked a bit about how someone gave me one of the biggest compliments I've ever had, which was when they were playing with Glabagool. They said, good God, Ed, the thing that playing with you and Glabagool, it's like having a philosophy lecture every single gaming session. That was really cool.
I couldn't work out if I'd be complimented or offended by that.
I was hugely complimented.
I'm glad you were really...
Yeah. I was definitely very, very complimented. But because to be honest, basically, Glabagool had three other characters inside them at the time, and then got, like, I'm not going to say that, I was going to say something I shouldn't have said, but then got smacked by the Demogorgon. And like fired hundreds of feet over the other side of the battlefield, yet survived. And because they survived, all of the characters that were inside them survived as well.
That was
amazing.
That's so cool.
However, I do have to say that completely unexpectedly, I mean, I thought it was going to be effective, but I didn't realize it was going to be that effective, was when Viorica cast, I can't remember what the spell was, but we managed to fool the beardy, the crow beard person completely.
Oh my goodness, yes.
That was amazing.
I'd forgotten that.
And it was just, it was a proper thing of like, okay, well, the campaign just ended because they just, the big bad just buggered off.
Was it Major Image?
It was something like that. Exactly. Basically, I fooled them into thinking that I'd broken the thing that they were searching for, and so then they just left.
Yes.
Which was perfect.
For people who haven't seen Seekers of Elturel Buried, this is a campaign that Ed and I both played, and it is still one of my favourites, DM'd by the exceptional George Lockett. And it was the penultimate episode. We were in the final bit of the dungeon. We had finally defeated the enormous plant monster guardian thing that was guarding this huge artifact that we needed to save the world.
Exactly.
And then the person we thought was Big Bad, who actually was second to the Big Bad who popped up in the final episode, turned up and was like, haha, thank you for defeating the monster. Now give me the artifact. And we were all like, oh, we're tapped. We're exhausted. We're injured.
There's nothing to do. Yeah.
Oh, no. And then Ed's magnificent bard, Viorica, who, is it fair to say, comes across as quite unassuming?
Very much so. I mean, a diva of the worst kind, but at the same time, yes, no, not one who you think is going to take the campaign by the scruff of the neck. Certainly not.
It was a party full of strong personalities.
Mm-hmm. It was amazing.
And Viorica stepped forward and cast. I want to say it was something like Major Image, and you made Crowbeard believe that you'd broken this artifact. And he just turned around and walked home, right? He was like, oh, well, screw you then.
Well, but which completely made sense, because the thing was that they had travelled. He? Can't remember what the thing
Don't
was.
Remember.
But he had travelled, I mean, miles and miles. And then it looked like everything, we just brought everything down. It was all bad. And that's why I think, because that was defeat without bloodshed as well, which feels like a very big thing. Because, like, killing stuff and destroying stuff is all well and good, and it's extremely good fun, but it feels much more impressive, and that's why I think this is my favorite character moment. It feels much more impressive to be able to do something and then for everyone to go, wait, what just happened? As opposed to a sort of grinding, like, I'm just going to bash this thing to death with a spoon, you know? It sort of doesn't...
But spoons are fun.
Oh, no, absolutely. But what I mean is, it's just, if it takes two sessions and it's just like, oh, God, I just got to keep killing him, I haven't got any spells left, then after a while that becomes a little bit depressing. Whereas when you just do something surprising and wonderful... Okay. Sorry, I'm being bashed about a bit in my boat.
Ooh, you're all right.
Yes, no, it's fine.
The perks and the downsides of living on a boat.
Yes.
I also think, Viorica is obviously the character I have played with, so the one I have of yours closest to my heart. But Viorica was particularly brilliant at maybe not epic, but spectacularly beautiful character moments.
That was amazing, because also it was the thing that I saved that one up for such a long time, because I've been wanting to say it for ages, because background thing, your character at the end of Buried wasn't allowed to go home, which was heartbreaking, but then but that's what I mean, and it's the thing that then I suddenly thought, well, hang on, this is two characters who don't have homes, because in a previous campaign Viorica's burnt down, and therefore they were both just lost people. And there is something so romantic about lost souls, because if you can find a way to have a home, which isn't, because I don't know if it's an English thing, but there's very much a sort of bricks and mortar thing about a home, and that a home is your castle and all of that kind of stuff. But I don't believe that's true at all, particularly not as I live on a boat, because it seems to be a completely separate thing, because I now never have to move house again, except literally. Which is quite nice, because it means that wherever I am will just be home. And that was kind of the effect that I was doing with Viorica and your character. It was the thing of, I thought, well, home doesn't need to be a specific place, and therefore if you can find a way of making wherever you are home, then that's a really lovely idea, and also means that you're never far away from home, which is lovely.
Yeah. Completely. Oh, you've made me have feelings. Oh. There is a really soppy Billy Joel song that is one of my favourite songs ever. It's called You're My Home. And it's exactly that idea that I could go anywhere, live anywhere. It doesn't matter as long as I'm with you. You are my home. Deeply, deeply soppy. But it's just, a lovely thing that D&D can capture beautifully. Or the found family tropes can have truth in them.
Exactly. And that's what I mean, because that's the thing. D&D has this reputation as very much like swords and sandals and like dungeon grinding and bashing people up and stuff like that. But it became incredibly beautiful. It does help if you have actors playing, but it's completely not necessary. And actually, I think the best group combination is if you have a couple of theatrical people. They don't actually need to be actors, but people who are big, because then they can be the ones who take on the what do you call it? Like the meat and potatoes of getting the thing going, because it's a good imagination thing. But then if you have somebody who's quiet and sits and just thinks about what everybody's saying, then they can come out with the most beautiful and really unexpected things. I'm thinking specifically of Emma, Chris's other half, who is I've only been DM'd by her once, and unfortunately we had to curtail the campaign. But M's long range DMing is the best I've ever heard of. The way that Chris describes it, the Easter eggs that get put in there and stuff like that. And that's what I mean. I think it's just being showy and sort of theatrical is one thing, but the yin to that yang is very much the thing of sitting and thinking and being quiet, which I think is very, very impressive.
Absolutely. I have the game where I have my Firefly Bard mirror. We play, there's a couple of us are actors. We're all theater adjacent. So actors, a director, and then one of us is a writer. And he is wonderful just as a human being and as a player, but he'd never played D&D before and really didn't want to do the role play of I actually speak the words of my character. Oh, wow. So struggled for a little, but he found this most beautiful way of doing it, which was narrating essentially she's called Dex, his character. She's a rogue. She's amazing. What she says and does. And it is just as impactful, if not more, as an actor going and giving it, because there's all that nuance and all that creativity, and you get all of the description around it. Yeah.
That's so cool.
Playing with actors is great fun. But yeah, I would hate to only ever play with actors, because that's, I think, the beauty of what other people can bring.
Exactly. And also, then it just becomes a thing of competing egos, and that is not a way to run a D&D game. Like, that doesn't work. Exactly.
But I'm not even going to roll the dice again, because I need to ask you.
Ooh.
You've told me so many epic character moments, but I want to know, what is the most epic moment that your Warriors of Waterdeep character has had so far? And I would like you to tell me their full name, please.
Oh, this is really unfair. This is such a thing. Okay. My character. Okay, hang on. My character's full name is. I can't even do it. Okay, is Halvanet. I can't, for some reason, this is a thing that I thought was just a funny thing in which I played with a couple of times, and now I really can't say it. It's really annoying. Halvanet Saladanel. No. Anyway.
I think that was beautiful.
Thank you.
And it made me giggle. I'm very sorry.
It's fine. Anyway, my favorite thing that they've done. Hang on. There's some other bits as well. Then discovering that how to have fun again was great, and I feel like that was I feel like that was exemplified when they cast a massive guiding bolt on the wall and blasted through it, and then made it all rainbow colours. I went, now that's fabulous, and that was one of my favourite pieces of improvisation I've ever done in my life, because it was just, I thought, well, hang on, I can make it colours, it's a whole wall, it's kind of a square, this is totally happening. And then it became a thing, which was really, really nice, because just to be clear, I am I hope a huge ally of the LGBTQA+ community, although I am not. In fact, to be honest, if you're going to be harsh about it, I do not have a single minority like atom in my body, which is a shame, but therefore means that I do need to work hard to be an ally, and also to try and be empathetic to those who do have issues with these kind of things, if you see what I mean, because it's really, really tough seeing it, because I have to sit there sort of going, okay, I just can't imagine what this is like to go through. And therefore anything that I can do, this is why it was so pleasing for me, because part of the thing with Warriors of Waterdeep is the idea was to not be a gender that you are. If you see what I mean, your character isn't the same. And I've nearly always played male characters. Partly because it's easier, but also because I felt like I wasn't going to be I didn't have enough experience of playing a gender other than my own to allow the characters to develop as much as I wanted them to. I've now played lots of female characters and non-gender characters and stuff like that, so therefore now I feel like I'm perfectly happy with it, but it was a big deal for me taking it on to begin with, and it's been a real positive experience.
I have to confess, the only time I've ever played a character who's not deliberately female is when I want to play someone who's particularly a masculine, pompous ass.
Yes. And it's very, very easy to play those people, because we've all met them, and they're very, very annoying. And that's, I think, exactly the thing. But
never for longer than a four shot is, I think, the longest. One shots or four parters. I have no interest in playing pompous ass for longer than four episodes.
Oh my God. Well, it's also because this was the thing with Viorica, because Viorica, the character, it was never that explicit, I don't think, but the idea was that they were castrati, because I really wanted to play that thing of they felt like they were male, but everything that's in the stereotype of making somebody male, it was taken away. Mm-hmm. And therefore, how does that work in a very, because the D&D world can be a very hyper-masculine world, in as much as might is right and strength is the thing that you go with. And that's why I thought it was really interesting to play a character like that, because how would they react to the world and how would the world react to them? And the answer is not well, but that was exactly what I wanted to find out.
It is one of my favourite things about Roll Together, that there is absolutely no sense of, it's a boys' club!
Yeah.
Which is fairly obvious when you think of people who run it and then the core players, but
absolutely
love that. And our chat as well, the people who watch every week are generally spectacularly lovely, and in no way, it's a boys' club, and I love it so much.
There's no gatekeeping in this, which is really, really important. And I was definitely, when I started playing, it was a bunch of spotty teenagers who couldn't talk to anybody else. And so, because this is the thing, this is what I think is interesting. There's a lot of stuff which, when it is a boys' club, is not necessarily because they don't want the girls there. It's just they can't imagine the girls being there, because why would the girls want to be there?
Because it's great.
Well, this is the thing, and this is the problem, is that how do you put it? It's kind of the cooties thing, do you know? Don't touch me, I don't want you, you know. But the problem is that never left me until I was probably about 18.
Well, bless you.
I know, which is a great shame.
Did you go to a boys' school?
Yes.
Oh, you poor thing.
That's what I mean. And so from the age of 13 to 18, just when I was supposed to be finding out about girls and understanding sort of what makes them tick, I was just wandering around with other boys in an incredibly homophobic place, which just meant that I was like, oh, when I went to university, I was like, oh, there's other humans here, not there are girls, because that was the thing. And that's what I mean. So exactly, it's so wonderful that Roll Together are playing RPGs without any of that kind of stuff. Because to be honest, there was no, and actually specifically, the idea of having a romantic entanglement in D&D, when it's all three of you boys and all three of you are spotty teenagers, this is not going to happen. It'd be too weird. Whereas now, I mean, embarrassingly, I've had better relationships in D&D over the past 5 years, potentially, than I've had in real life. Which is, you know, I think that's my fault rather than anything else. But it's really lovely when you do have good relationships in D&D. It's lovely.
Yeah, for sure. We're getting very profound. Shall we roll the die before we both start weeping?
Yes, indeed.
Excellent.
Let's get back to the,
Oh, that's much more of a Rebecca roll. That is a 19. You answered question 19, so I'm going to pretend it was a 17, which is deeply, deeply appropriate, because question 17 is, how do you feel about fudging rolls?
Okay. So a thing that got inculcated into me when I was younger is that there is no point in cheating, because then there's no point in playing the game. If all you're going to do is cheat, then it isn't a game anymore. It's just the thing. So winning at all costs was never a thing for me, and cheating was never a thing for me, because, I mean, I did cheat. You have to sort of find out what it's like. Hmm. But at the same time, it was never a sort of thing of like, I'm cheating, because that's not cool at all. Hmm. When you say fudging roles, do you mean as in like, oh, we'll just say that it worked for the sake of doing stuff? Or do you mean genuinely like changing them to be better because you want them to be better?
I mean, the question just says that. I guess there's two different things, aren't there? There's the DM's like rule of cool.
That's exactly what I was
kindness.
Right.
And then there's a player going, I really wanted to pass this, so I didn't roll a 3, I rolled a 19.
Yeah, exactly. Because so those are two very different things. The rule of cool, I think, is vital to make to making games better. Being too adhered to the rules just gets really annoying after a while and can mean the death of a campaign if the players feel like they're not being allowed to spread their wings properly. The fudging rule, that's completely unacceptable. I mean, absolutely unacceptable, because it makes it completely pointless. OPing, like overpowering a character, is kind of fine, but it's annoying. It's in the same way that, like, I do think that you need to have somebody who's keen on the rules in a D&D group, because I think that it means that the DM's then kept on their toes, which is a good thing. But somebody who just wants to win at any cost is stupid. Like, you can't win at Dungeons & Dragons. It doesn't work. You're just supposed to be having a lovely time. And fudging a role goes completely against that, because then you can't trust the player. And then there's no point. And that's really, really annoying.
So I think... Oh, no, sorry.
What were you going to say?
I was just thinking you can expand that out, because I think we definitely both agree on, why would you bother? You should just write a script.
Yes.
But I reckon you should expand that out. I wonder what you think in terms of OP. Like, I don't enjoy playing a character who is good at everything. You need to suck at least one thing. And I know Chris, his lot, encourages players in their campaigns to suck at something.
Yeah.
But also thinking in terms of how D&D is balanced as a game, things like... wizards who maybe can do slightly less damage, maybe per round, but they can keep going until their spell slots run out, versus warlocks or paladins who are exceptional for two rounds of combat.
Yeah.
And so you have to balance that by having the short ones where you can smite, and then the longer rounds where, the paladins or the warlocks are a bit useless now, and then the long form characters come into play. I love that kind of balance. And in my head, it's also kind of fudging if you're like, well, my character will only be powerful and cool for two rounds of combat, so we must never play more than two rounds of combat.
Yes, I see what you mean. Ah, okay. Well, I think that leads into trying to control the game. Because I think that a player who tries to control the game and be in control at all times is not going to enjoy themselves. And that's because the thing is, if you're trying to be somebody who's good at everything and never fails a role, then already you're doing it wrong, because again, you're trying to win, and then that doesn't work. The thing is that, but what you say is really interesting, because what it implies is that it's kind of up to D&D to solve those problems, as in like with adjustments and rule tweaks and things like that, and bringing out extra stuff, as in like, if you are a character that wants to play OP, as you say, I don't think either of us two want to do that, but it is really, really useful having them in your group occasionally. David Frias, who has presented this before, I'm playing in a campaign with him at the moment where he is a sword singer bard or something like that.
Cool.
But it's not that quite. But the thing is that they're when they've got themselves set up, when they have a couple of turns to go, right, I'm going to set up the sword singing and stuff like that, it means that their armor class is basically never lower than 27, which is insane.
David, maxing out a character, what?
But that's exactly what I mean. But the thing is, it is really useful, because you're just watching an entire, goblin horde trying to strike at this character, and it just, no one hitting them is hilarious.
Yes.
And I don't think either you or I would come up with a character like that, because we don't know how to fix things like that. So that's what I mean. I think it is, if you've got a character, it's vitally important to be able to explore, like push the edges in D&D and find out what the edges are for a DM as well, because the DM then has to go, and again, keeps them on their toes, which I think is a very, very good thing for a DM. But also, therefore, if you're a character, and also if you're a rules lawyer, which I wouldn't accuse David of being, but can edge towards that, I think it's vital for, again, for the D&D on the DM on their toes bit, it's vital for somebody to know the rules as well or better than the DM, because it keeps them there, keeps them honest, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, for sure.
because I think that does work well.
Yeah, because I would hate D&D the game to tweak itself so you could never play someone that OP. That would be upsetting. Exactly. I think it's much more to do with the DM making sure everyone has a chance to be brilliant. And if you have one character who is consistently making everyone else at the table, I mean, I don't know, I've never had this experience because all my players and DMs are lovely. Exactly. But I can imagine if you have one player who's like, I can do everything, all of you are useless, then having a DM who can create a scenario where that person, nope, sorry, none of your skills work, you're tired out, sit down.
Exactly, but that's what I'm saying about it. So that shouldn't necessarily be up to the DM though. The DM should have the tools to be able to do that from D&D. Because I think that because the feedback, particularly now that we've got the internet and how much feedback that allows to go back to Dungeons & Dragons and for them to make informed decisions about how the game can be made better through discussion with players and DMs, obviously. But that means that there is a bigger thing, therefore, than the DM themselves, which they should be able to rely on. And therefore, you should be able to have any of that and also be able to sort out the problems that are created by OP characters. Because there isn't a right way to, it's as you say, there isn't a right way to play. The way that we play is sort of soft and fluffy and lovely, but there should also be campaigns that allow for massively OP characters, definitely.
For sure.
Yeah.
And also, like we were talking about, if you're talking about winning, you're doing it wrong. It's about storytelling and sharing your spotlight. I wouldn't want to play in a campaign where I am the best all the time.
God, it'd be really boring.
Boring.
Really dull. And also, in which case, why the hell have you got? I mean, can you imagine just playing a one-on-one, just like a one-player D&D camp?
Do you know, I actually did that. I think I taught that in my last interview with Niall. But
really?
That was with my husband, well, with my then fiance.
Yes.
While I was on tour for 4 months. So we did it as a long distance way to keep us connected. So we didn't just have the like, how was your day? Fine. How was your day? Fine. Good night.
So
we played
so wholesome.
Over the phone a one-on-one D&D campaign.
Okay, well, that's the coolest thing
I've ever heard. With that caveat, I wouldn't like to do it just other than, yes, as a long-distance relationship thing.
Well, I mean, then it feels like it's more than a D&D thing. It's D&D allowing you to, like, cement your relationship. That is really beautiful, by the way.
Thanks.
He's
a good one.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, just keep hold of that one. Absolutely.
I will.
But, because even thinking about it... Yes, but sorry, I was just considering back to a thing that Chris and I attended. I mean, it was 5 years ago or something like that now, which was all the different ways that games and entertainment and theatre can kind of interlock. Mm-hmm. And what that showed me was how many different ways there are, because one of the things in the different ways that can interlock was the news, because the news is like the ultimate expression of completely up-to-date and improvisational, but at the same time hidebound by rules. Like the way that the news is presented is very traditional, but it's a complete, like, news anchors have to, in the most like straight and basic way, improv the entire time, and that's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
But it's stuff like that. And but also what amazes me with D&D, and part of the reason why I think it's exploded to the extent that it has, is that there are pretty much infinite ways of playing it, as you've just illustrated. It doesn't mean that, again, like, it's not the best way to play it the way that you were doing it, but it enabled you to do a thing. And it's exactly what you say. The idea of that, how was your day, darling? It was fine. How was your day, darling? That's awful. Whereas, what's your character going to do tonight? That would be absolutely great.
Can recommend it to anyone, any D&D nerdy couples in a long-distance relationship.
It's a really good idea.
I'm being soppy. I will roll the die again to stop me from carrying on being soppy. That was a 10. Have we had 10? We have had 10. I'm not going to fudge it because that last question made me feel guilty. I'm going to roll again.
Okay.
That is a natural 20.
Wow.
It's me. I'm surprised I haven't rolled at least 5 of them by now.
Nobody else celebrates how well they roll dice. This is really cool.
I've got the point where I feel like I can't celebrate because it's so ridiculous by this point. I feel like I have to apologise for every nat 20 instead.
Amazing.
I may have to get rid of all of my dice and start again
just to start again.
But I can't because they're all beautiful and I love them. Okay, 20 is which character was the hardest to say goodbye to? And this doesn't actually specify whether it was your character or someone else's, so knock yourself out.
Oh, the hardest to say goodbye to. Yeah. I think, Okay, so we, again with Chris's lob, and this was ridiculously ambitious. Basically, we set up a world that we would try and get, Chris's lob was the DM, and there were, at one stage there must have been over 30 other players. Like, it was insane. But the idea was that it happened every Wednesday night, and whoever turned up could play. So it was very, very rare that we had anything more than 10 players, but it was a revolving cast. And the idea was that it was centered around a town, like a Wild West town kind of thing. But that what the players said and did would inform the rest of the world. So it was a kind of like auto-generative, it wasn't just the DM doing the thing, but it was allowing all of the characters to have a choice in it. And the character who I was playing, because we had three characters who represented kind of the good aspect of the world, the neutral aspect of the world, and the evil aspect of the world. And so the opening episode was amazing, because the evil character decided to like lightning bolt, you know, what's it called, the Emperor, what the Emperor does to Luke Skywalker at the end of Return of the Jedi, did that to my character, because this character had been found covered in blood in a brothel that was just full of dead prostitutes.
Oh dear.
Yeah, it was a really serious like opening image, and my character was normally the sheriff of the Wild West town, and kind of the opening thing was finding this child in the brothel and who had killed all the prostitutes. It was that kind of feeling. So it was a really serious opening thing. But then the child character lightning bolted my character, accusing my character of being the person who did all of this stuff. And because my character was so good, if you see what I mean, they didn't say that it wasn't them. They took, as it were, took on the thing of like, okay, if the town is going to decide that it was my fault, then it was my fault. It was that kind of thing.
Interesting.
That was
how logic.
This was why it was so interesting. It was so because I'd never played like a properly good character before. It had always been like chaotic good or something like that. This was a properly lawful good character. That's what I mean. And that was why it was so interesting to play. Oh my God, this is what I mean about having, because this went on for years, I think, this campaign. And there were a couple of characters who turned up who were trickster, pale elf, dark elf, bards. And somehow my character managed to seduce and get into a relationship with the wife of this couple.
I thought you were lawful good.
This is what I mean. So the character development in this was just astonishing. And not only that, but this again is David. My character and the wife, who wasn't my wife, but referred to as wife, both got killed, but then brought back as different.
You talked about this last time.
Oh my God.
This is where David with his snake popped up, right?
Absolutely.
That was a terrible phrasing.
The wife. But it was the thing, it was one of the harshest things in the world, because I was sitting there, like, so angry is the wrong word, but so sort of with all the feels about the fact that my character was dead and I didn't know whether we were going to be revived or not. And then David came along and found my character paralyzed for some reason and then said, if you're local, move your body, which just everybody in the entire room collapsed with laughter except for me. It was very harsh.
So you were trying to grieve.
Yeah, exactly. But it was the thing that what was annoying, not annoying at all, but what was the character did come back as a dark elf, and the wife character came back as a kobold.
Gosh.
And so that was kind of like, so then it was the thing of like, they are not an attractive thing anymore. Do I still, no, but that's okay. A kobold is
Reasonable. That was sympathetic. I mean? Oh, not a you should feel guilty. Oh.
I mean, to be fair, because I do see what you mean. Like the easy, obvious thing to do would sort of go, you're a kobold. I'm not fancying you anymore. But it feels to me like it's very, very important that love goes beyond that.
Yeah, and of course.
Certainly in my head, my character was definitely much more in love with, and it didn't matter what form they were in. It was just, I was in love with that essence. And that was the thing, because then it was only a session or two after that they both got killed, like, for real.
Oh no, I didn't know that bit.
That's what I mean, but that was the problem, is that having got them back in this warped form, I was totally ready for them to go on forever and to carve out a wonderful life, but then they died. And that was, so it felt like that thing of, you know, in a film when they kill off a character, but then the character comes back at the end. I'm always very ambivalent about that because it's lovely, because it's like, oh, the character's back. And if they've done a decent job, then it's really good that the character comes back. But there's also a thing of like, you made a decision to kill that character.
Yeah.
And it would have been really interesting and really affecting if you'd actually let that character die. As it is, there's nothing... It's kind of like, oh, well, of course you're going to bring it back because that's easier. And the thing was that what I had was, I'd had the awful feeling of like, I've really lost this character. Oh, the characters come back. Oh, but they're different. Oh, I guess that means that love triumphs over all in this. Oh, no, they're dead again. Yeah. So there was nothing positive kind of left. I don't mean that Christy ended badly. It was literally, there was nothing else that could happen.
I'll be honest, I was just thinking, as this is a sign of how well Christy ends. Like I hear sometimes people say that playing a safe table means it's all tame and very boring and there are no feelings, but actually I think, yeah, Chris and Roll Together in general are proof of how if you make sure everyone is, there's no real world triggers or things that will upset someone, then you can chuck yourself into the fantasy land and have all of the feelings.
Yeah, completely. And also if somebody like, because because I have a very interesting thing with this, which I find interesting, is that I don't like trigger warnings. I understand that they're very important. Sorry, let me make this very clear. I think they have a vital part in the world. I don't like them for me because it feels like then I'm just expecting them. And I can see what somebody says about, like, if you're at a safe table with no trigger warnings, then it can feel tame. But only if your characters then can't do anything but react.
Yep.
Because if the characters actually get to do and say and be, like, as you say, like, all of the feelings can happen, then it can be absolutely earth-shattering. And nothing has to happen to them to make those feelings. It can just come from them. And that's actually more effective, I think.
Yeah, for sure. But then I can understand why you would slap a trigger warning on someone who was then watching your game to be like, in case you really don't like giant spiders, we do improv around them for half an hour. It's a useful tool, I think.
Completely.
But yes, I can see that you wouldn't want them in a way that means you must never, ever, ever go outside your tiny little box.
That is completely the thing. But also, because what Chris talks about is stuff like torture. Like, let's not have that. There's no need. The thing is, it doesn't mean that it can't happen, but let's not have it on screen, as it were, because there's no need. It's just really unpleasant. And also stuff to do with child abuse, stuff like that.
Why would you put that in your game?
That's what I mean, yeah. Unless there was a very, very specific... I'm not saying that it should never, ever, ever, ever go in, but also, unless there's a really specific reason, what are we doing? Because it just seems unnecessary. And I think that's the sort of dividing line. It's not that you're ruling anything out. It's just allowing people for whom it can be really traumatic, that kind of stuff, to just not have to deal with it. I think that's completely fair and completely right.
Yeah. And we were talking earlier, there's no right way to play D&D. It can tick so many different boxes. You can have, I mean, I have different games that do different things. I have the stupid chaotic game with no plot where we giggle for 3 hours and then go to bed.
Yeah.
and then I have the games that are very, you know, we have no real world prejudices, anything like that whatsoever. Yeah, it's complete fantasy. Yeah. But then I also have a campaign where there is sexism, there are, you know, bad people and some inbuilt prejudices, but because it's played with a DM I trust implicitly and with players I trust completely, that then becomes a wonderful thing. Well, in the real world, if this happened, I would have to smile politely and try and get out of the room safely. But in this universe, I will cast a spell and make you apologize. Like,
brilliant. Oh, lovely.
I do love having that space.
Oh, being able to, but actually, I never thought of it like that, because I thought it's like, okay, you can put yourself in the situation and it can be resolved well. But actually, as it were, forcing the big bad to grovel. Oh, God, that must be
great. It is beautiful. And I wouldn't want it in every game I played.
No.
A specific group of very close friends.
Yes. Wow.
Who would never cross any lines. Knowing, yeah. I've talked about it before, it's my Edgelord campaign. But yes, knowing that these horrible things that we try not to think about in the real world, if we put them in safely in here, then we conquer them.
Yes, exactly.
Because
it allows. Yeah. Because it allows, because I was talking about putting yourself into situations which you might be scared of, and you can see it might not work out well, but you can see it's not as scary. That, what you're talking about, is positive affirmation. It's like, it's something that you can do where it's like, I might never be able to do this in the real world, but I can get to do it somewhere. That's vital. That's amazing.
It's really fun.
Yeah. Oh, you inspired me. Thank you.
I'm very inspirational. I reckon, given our length of waffling, we have time for one more question.
Okay.
Do you have a particular question you are desperate for me to ask you, or shall we leave it to chance?
Let's leave it to chance. I'm much keen on that.
Excellent. Ooh, that is, what a good question to end on. That is a 16.
Okay.
If you could make yourself in D&D, who and what would you be?
Ah, well, fascinatingly, my friend G had a whole thing about this. There is a man who thinks outside the envelope when it comes to creating
this
characters.
This is G as in G.
Sorry, Gerald. Yeah, Gerald McDermott.
Yeah.
He has talked about making himself, and you'd have to be quite bad, because you're a very, very basic human. Like, you know how humans have a +1 to everything? He's like, I wouldn't take that.
Yeah, because of course as a human, not. You'd have to pick your race as well as your class. You wouldn't ever just go with basic human.
But what I thought was interesting is that, because he was talking about actually creating himself literally in a D&D
game. Oh, boy.
He'd be so squishy. But yeah. he would have an amazing like knowledge of electronics.
Yes. So, and really good sleight of hand with all his art skills.
That's what I mean, is exactly all of that kind of stuff. So I'm taking it that that's not the question, but I think
I was more thinking of if you had to pick a race and a class, I guess. But if you want to answer the G version, then not.
No. I will let G do that when he gets a chance on here, if he does. But yes, if I was okay, so I thought about this a lot, and there's a difference between like wish fulfillment and what you think you actually would be.
Gotcha.
So. Because I can't remember them off the top of my head, but there's a set of questions which you can answer, which is what kind of animal you think you are, and it's the thing of what you think other people see you as, and what you think you see yourself as, all that kind of stuff. And the one that I got for what I think other people see me as was polar bear, you know, this sort of lonesome, vicious animal who goes striding around and no one sees. And then actually the one that I see myself as was a wombat, Technically, little.
If it helps, in my head, you're much closer to a wombat than a polar bear.
Completely. I think that is actually the thing that people do see, because that is what I am. And that's what I mean about, that's why thinking about it was interesting. Because if I was just going to do wish fulfillment, I would definitely be like a dark elf assassin. Do you know what I mean? Something, like you say, something pretty edgelordy, to be brutally honest. Something pretty like dark and mysterious. And if you come to a party, like, I won't talk to you, but if you come and talk to me, it's that kind of.
Are you in a cape?
Yes, obviously. Yeah. Exactly. And all of that kind of stuff, and purple eyes and all of that kind of thing. I think if I was actually, I'm not sure. It feels like it would be a Firborg or a Goliath. Ooh, or actually possibly, what I'd really like to be. Okay, I'll answer this because I'd really like to be. And actually, I've talked about this with Chris and Emma. When in the campaign that was DM'd by Emma, I played a character called Norodom Moniniath, who was a tortal monk, but who was actually a jester. And therefore, but also it was just the way that I thought about it was like, so this is really hectic, but so the he was taught to be a jester by his mother and father, who had been enslaved by somebody who lived in a castle, and that was all he knew, was the castle, and being, you know, doing what's it called, tightrope walking, but looking as though you're going to fall off the entire time, but never actually doing it. It's that kind of stuff.
A tortoise on a tightrope is a vision.
Do you know what I mean? I love this idea, because I just love the idea of a turtle being really graceful and like balletic, but looking as though they had no idea what they were doing.
Yeah, that's amazing.
But so, and then also the thing was that then when the original person who owned the castle, like that king, died, then his son comes to the throne, who is a bastard. And so the Noridom then has to, he just has to make them laugh. And they, but the problem is that in order to make them laugh, he has to dance on, you know, hot metal and stuff like that. So it's a thing, it stops being a thing of, oh, this is a joyous thing, making people laugh. It's like, I have to make people laugh, otherwise it's going to hurt. It's going to hurt really, really badly. And therefore, if there is any point where Noridom can be funny, then he has to be funny. And he can't stop himself. And this means that it just makes the most wonderful role-playing thing, because it's like, oh, I could do something funny there. Ugh, guys, I'm really sorry. Noridom has got to dive off the building, or, you know, sit on the whoopee cushion, or whatever it is. And it just made for such a wonderful sort of like, oh no, I could do something really effective here, but he's got to do something funny.
No. And
that feels like how I would... It feels like, as it were, how I would like to be in real life. Not the sort of tortured...
Okay, good, because I was about to get slightly concerned, but...
No. It's much more the thing of, I love the idea of viewing being funny as like a vocation rather than just a thing that you can occasionally do. And because then I think that once people understand what you're doing, it would be amazing. I think that would be what I would like to be, is a total jester. In D&D, that's exactly
that
what
is
I'd like to be like.
Spectacular, and I can see it really, really well. Ed Cartwright, the Tortle Jester.
Indeed, that's my plan.
If anyone watching has artistic skills, please draw me a picture of that. I want it.
Me too.
Ed probably wants it more, to be fair. Ed, first him. I think that brings us to the end of our time. So, before we finish, Ed, do you have anything you'd like to plug?
No. Well. I mean, apart from Roll Together, no, I think I'm...
Yeah, watch Roll Together, we're great.
Yes, because it's good. It's fun. I like it.
Brilliant. Well, thank you, Ed, very much for coming and talking to me for an hour. It was a pleasure.
It was lovely.
And thank you, everyone watching, for joining us. It was very nice of you. Ooh. If you enjoyed this, we hope you did. We stream every Friday from 6 till 7 BST at the moment. And then we stream D&D games on Mondays and Tuesdays. On Mondays, 6 till 9 p.m. GMT. And on Tuesdays, the same time again, I think, 6 till 9 GMT. No. Let's see if I can remember what we're doing. Oh, I can, because on Mondays, it's the campaign I'm in.
yes.
Niall is DMing the Eternal Army. And on Tuesday, it's your campaign, isn't it, Ed?
Yes.
What is it?
It is the Ludia sponsored Warriors of Waterdeep campaign, which is, yes, it's getting very silly, is the wrong word. Intense. It's going very good. Very, very good.
Not intense and silly?
Yes, I think that, which is the best way, potentially.
Can confirm, it is a fantastic stream. I'm not in it. I'm unbiased. It's great fun to watch. Can recommend the Tuesday night stream. Also the Monday, I am in that one. It's
indeed
awesome.
Likewise, yes.
All of our shows stream at twitch.tv/rolltogetherRPG. And there is also a YouTube link in chat for all of our archive of shows. And don't forget, you can also find us and enjoy us as a podcast. Mm-hmm. Lastly, many thanks again to our D20 Club on Patreon, all of our sponsors and supporters, and I can't believe I have to say this, stay classy at the table.
I'd forgotten that was a thing. Yes, stay classy at the table.
Good night.
Good night.